Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Hoo-wah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciates you joining us this fine day in America. We are proud Americans. Here's what we have for you this hour. We'll start by talking with Korean War vet Howard Davis. Then Coast Guard vet Mark Northrup will share about getting benefits from the VA. And we'll introduce a new segment, Borders and Books. Of course, we'll conclude with military history and our self-defense report. It's a pleasure to introduce my friend Howard Davis. Howard's a Korean War vet. He was an enlisted infantryman. Yes, we'll discuss the Korean War. Howard later became a pastor. He lived quite a life. So welcome, Howard.
Happy to be here.
Howard, when and why did you decide to join the Marines?
Well, in June of 1948, the government passed a draft law. And if you belonged to an organized reserve unit, you would not be drafted. Three of my friends and I went down and joined the National Guard at noon. We were down there that night to get our physical examination. And one of my friends said, "Say, I saw on the front page of the Grandpa's Press they need a man in the Marine Corps Reserve." And so we quickly reasoned, "Oh man, that's better than the National Guard," and went up and joined the Marine Corps Reserve. So I always call us accidental Marines. We never talked about or thought about anything about joining the Marine Corps, but we did. And then draft law was for 2 years, and we signed for 3 years. So 2 years later, when the war was started, if you were an active reserve and for 2 years, you were deemed combat ready. And so then we skipped boot camp, went right on active duty.
So you're one of the few people in the military, any branch of the military, who went into combat without ever having been to boot camp. Am I right?
That's right. I later read in the Marine Corps Gazette that there were about 8,500 of us in the Marine Corps Reserve that so qualified, and that's the only time, as I understand, in the history of the Marine Corps, that men served as enlisted men without going to boot camp, and I'm one of those.
Well, that's a distinction that you probably, if your kids had gone in the Marines, you probably didn't want to have that distinction, right?
Right. We did go. I did have 4 weeks of infantry training at Tent Camp 2 and Camp Pendleton, so we did get some infantry training.
Well, that's reasonable that you got trained because you're with a unit and the unit trained, right?
Well, when we were activated, most of them had to go to boot camp because they did not have the 2 years in. Just a handful of us were designated to different places.
Okay. So you served in the reserves 2 weeks each summer or something until the Korean War started and you were deployed, right?
That's right.
I take it you went over in a boat, a ship?
We took a ship over from San Diego. It was a 23-day journey. We landed, stopped at Kobe, Japan, and dropped off our sea bags, and then proceeded to Pohang on the southeast coast of South Korea. We disembarked by climbing over the side on one of those rope ladders and got on LST, and that took us into the beach.
Okay, and at the beach, I take it they marched you to or sent you to whatever unit you were going to be assigned to?
Yes, the whole 1st Marine Division was there. One of my friends went in the 1st Marines, and another one of my friends and myself went in the 7th Marines. And then went in and I signed with the 1st Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment, walked in a tent, and there was 4 tables there, and I went to the table that was Able Company. Then I went to Able Company, and they sent me to the 3rd Platoon. And in the 3rd Platoon, they assigned me to the 3rd Squad. So I was a rough man of the 3rd Squad, 3rd Platoon of Able Company, 1st Battalion, 7th Marines.
And with that, you went into combat.
Exactly right. Yes. We left. They left Pohang about 2 or 3 days later. We rode in the back of trucks and went online at Wanju, which is a considerable distance south of the 38th parallel.
So the war had started. The 38th parallel had been the dividing line. The North Koreans had attacked south. You guys went to where the front was.
That's where the front was. The front was down by Wanju for us at that point.
Okay.
Then we proceeded right north.
And I would presume that within a day or two of your getting there, you were confronting the enemy.
Well, we had some little skirmishes. And then on March 8th, we had a big battle. And the platoon sergeant took my buddy and me, and we went to the left flank and out around the enemy. I had a Browning automatic rifle at that time. And we snuck in behind the enemy. And that was the first time I had to shoot at the enemy. There were about 6 or 7 huddled down behind a barricade, and I shot the whole 20 rounds into them. And then we didn't see other people there, and they started shooting at us, and we were running across a little saddle then. And the platoon sergeant all of a sudden went rolling down the hill in the snow. The snow was deep. And my buddy and I slid down there, and the sergeant had been shot twice right in the stomach. And what happened after that, my mind is a complete blank.
You know, I do understand that. When you're that intense, you're just acting. And the BAR was a great weapon. I thought I was going to be able to take one into combat, but they replaced it, and so I wasn't allowed to. So you're my hero for that, too.
I carried a BAR for about 2 months, and then I got an M1 rifle.
Okay. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Marine vet Howard Davis about the Korean War. After that, you were in some pretty heavy face-to-face combat, weren't you?
Well, you have a lot of minor skirmishes, and we had a big battle on April 21, 22, when the Chinese started their spring offensive. Yeah, that was quite a nightly battle. And if things were different that night, we were down on low ground, on up on the mountains. And for some reason, we stood a 1-4 watch instead of 50-50. So you had your own foxhole, and full moon that night. And luckily, I was on watch with the second watch because they came right at me and started the battle. And fast as I could pull the trigger.
Yes, sir. I understand that.
Went through several clips of ammunition and finally stopped him after he rushed me 3 times. And then it was kind of a different kind of battle the rest of the night. Next morning, we kind of snuck over that ridge, that little rise in the field, and shot a few of them, my buddies and I did. And one went off running down toward the river. And for some reason, I had in my mind I was going to bayonet him. And so I chased after him. And I always thought that guy must have been scared to death, this big old Marine hollering after him. And he stumbled and fell, and I was on him. And he rolled over and folded his hands like he was either begging or praying. And I didn't bayonet him, thank goodness. And I took him prisoner.
That's awesome. That's a great. And that leads me to my final question. You later became a pastor. You were a Christian. Were you a Christian when you deployed?
Yes, I was. Yeah.
And did that affect how you interacted with your teammates and how you acted in combat?
Yes. Well, what happened was when we boarded the ship, a man was there and gave us a little card with Psalm 121 on. It's sometimes called the Traveler Psalm or the Soldier Psalm. And in the RSV edition of that, the word keep is found there 6 times. And especially in verse 7, it says, the Lord is your keeper. And it wasn't there very long before we as a squad, 13 men, before we went into combat, would read that psalm. And then we'd pray that God would keep us, not necessarily alive or not necessarily not getting wounded, but just that God would keep us. And then when the day was over and those of us left, we'd get together and read Psalm 121 again and then pray that God would keep us and keep our fallen buddies who were no longer with us. The worst time was May 29. We started out with 63 men in our platoon and ended up with 13. And my squad of 13 started out, and there were 2 of us left that night. And I can still see us sitting there on the edge of our foxhole reading Psalm 121 and praying for our fellow Marines who are not with us and praying for ourselves, too, that God would keep us.
Amen, my friend. I wish we had more time. You then became a pastor. When you finished your time in the Marines, did you then decide to pursue becoming a pastor?
Well, I had thought that way, but I went to University of Michigan, got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. And actually would have gone to seminary right then. I made my mind to do that, but I got married and had a child. So I taught school for a couple years first at Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, and then went to Western Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan for 3 years, become a pastor of the Reformed Church in America.
Howard, thank you. Thank you for your service to our nation, in the Marines, in combat, and in presenting Christ to our citizens.
Okay,
God bless you.
I'd add just one thought.
Yes, sir.
We never regretted not joining the National Guard, but joining the Marines. We were very thankful we joined the Marines, all 3 of my buddies and me.
God bless you. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you, Danny.
Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll discuss getting disabilities approved by the VA with Mark Northrup. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time to do some knee bends. Go halfway down each time, do 40, and do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. I'll be right back.
GNS, a Korean-owned company operating in North America, will be supporting an effort to honor and respect the veterans who fought in the Korean War. This effort is done in conjunction with an organization called Project Soldier. Project Soldier is a nonprofit organization based in the US and Korea. Since 2013, it has been taking photographs and videos of Korean War veterans all over the world. GNS North America is honored to host Project Soldier August 6th to 15th in Michigan and Ontario. Project Soldier wants to interview and take photos of these veterans. They will then receive pictures and have their experience memorialized, which proudly tells of their sacrifice for freedom. If anyone knows any Korean War veterans nearby, please contact Joshua Roberts at jroberts@gnsauto.com. jroberts@gnsauto.com.
Fellow Americans, we need your help. PatriotFoods.com. We are fighting for the American farmer. U.S. only fruits and vegetables from your soil. Go to PatriotFoods.com. Use your promo code FREEDOM and you get 10% off today. Support your U.S. farmer. Promo code FREEDOM, 10% off. Thank you so much.
It's great food. I eat it. This is Colonel Danny Gillum. PatriotFoods.com. Promo code FREEDOM. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Frontlines of Freedom. It's a pleasure to welcome my good friend, the chair of the show's advisory board, and a Coast Guard vet, Mark Northrup. Welcome, bro.
Colonel, another great day in America.
It is, bro. Mark, start telling us about your time in the Coast Guard. When and why did you join?
Well, I joined the Coast Guard in 1980. It was going to be a three-year commitment, and I ended up staying pretty much for 14 years. The Navy would have been 4 years. I thought, well, you know, if I don't like it, I can bail out a little bit earlier. But in the end, every year was a great year, and I would do it all again if I could. I grew up in the service. My father and brother were both combat pilots. I was a little nearsighted, so I couldn't fly, so I thought I'd drive old Coast Guard cutters.
Well, and it was easier to not crash them into the earth, isn't it?
Okay. Let's not go there, Denny.
Okay, Mark. We've known each other for years. Both of us have taken on roles advocating for our veterans in the late chapters of their lives. Tell me a bit about what it is you're doing now helping veterans.
Well, you know, Denny, like most veterans, most of us continue to serve our country even after we get out of the uniform. It's how we've been hardwired. We seek to serve and continue to give back to our country. I was kind of semi-retired, and I approached my attorney and thought that maybe I could help him stand up supporting veterans and their disability claims. To my disappointment, I found out there's a lot of veterans out there that don't apply for their disabilities claims through the VA. Probably half the veterans out there have some lingering health issues due to their time in service. We would call that service connection. And there's just a reluctance on veterans to file for those disability claims and to get some compensation. That's more than just that reluctance, but the process is convoluted, it's bureaucratic, it's government. And I don't want to throw the VA under the bus, but it's not an easy process. It's not intuitive. You know, there's a veteran out there, or you're a veteran out there and your family, tell them to get some professional advice and to file for the claim and to get help filing for that claim, because the compensation is out there. The country says you're entitled. And you should reach out and get that help as you can.
So that's why most don't do it, is because it's just too confusing. Add that to a little bit of ego. I don't want to say that I need help. Is that basically the story?
That's it. You know, I hear a lot of veterans say, well, I'm not deserving. It's for the other guys. I'm okay. You know, it's too hard to file. And the list is endless. But at the end of the day, when you look the veteran in the eye and say, well, you know, would you be living like this with these pains and aches and these traumas you went through if you hadn't been in the service and your country says you're entitled? You should go file. You have nothing to lose to file. Now, the filing process is not easy, Denny. I'm not going to lie to you. It's complicated. I tell all of the veterans I work with, it's never one and done. It's a dynamic process. You'll have to continue to do over and over and over. And don't throw in the towel. Get professional help. There's a lot of veteran service officers out there with a lot of agencies. The Legion, the VFW, the states all have VSOs. And for the most part, they're really good. I happen to work for a private attorney. So we happen to have just a little bit of skin in the game by charging 20% of any back claim. So if you're a veteran, I tell them all, file intent, put your flag in the ground, because your compensation is from when you notify the VA you intend to file. So once you file intent, you have a year to file your claim, to gather your evidence and to establish service connection for those conditions. But file for that intent and put the flag in the ground, because that is when the compensation will be back paid to. As an attorney, working for an attorney, we get paid 20% of that back claim. Now, most veterans have kind of scratch their head and say, well, why? Well, there's just enough skin in the game for an attorney to make it interesting and to go after to get you the maximum amount. A veteran service officer, they're not your wingman necessarily, because they don't have any skin in the game. They're just going to file the paper and send it in. And that's good. But that's just one small piece. You have to be counseled. You have to be advised. You have to refile. You have to file the right kind of paperwork. And it's just an endless process that the veteran needs a lot of help with.
Okay. What are the kinds of elements that are part of a claim?
Well, there's really two. You have to establish you've had service connections. So if you're in the service, I'm telling all the veterans that are getting out, get a full copy of your medical record. Every time you've been a sick call is a piece of evidence. But like a lot of veterans, a lot of us never went to sick call because we're too proud and we wanted to make the deployment. So we never went to sick call. So quite often when you get out, now you have these conditions. Let's say you really broke your ankle in the service jumping out of a plane. Imagine that. You never went to sick call. I can't count the number of times that I've had a guy sit down with me and said, well, my ankle's bad. I said, well, did you go to sick call? He said, hell no, because I wanted to make the deployment because I was a good warrior, sir. Well, yeah, but now you're limping and you got a problem. So now you have to get witness statements. You have to go back and see a doctor. Your doctor has to say, yeah, this patient of mine broke his ankle while he's in the service and he still limps. And in my opinion, it happened while he was in the service. You have to gather that evidence and submit it. So first of all, you got to establish service connection. And then you got to go get the evidence that the condition that you're struggling with is still an active issue that needs to be cared for and get attention, and you can rate a disability. You know, the classic one is tinnitus. How many guys I sit down with, almost every one of them, I say, how's the ringing in your ears today? And they look at you like, what? How do you know I have ringing in my ears? Well, you're a veteran. Come on now. You're around small arms fire. You worked on the flight line. You worked on jets. Of course, your hearing stinks, but also you probably have what is called tinnitus. Tinnitus is probably one of the most common ailments that veterans have, because we've damaged our ears and our hearing while we were in the service. So tinnitus is just a classic one most veterans have, in addition to other kind of ailments, exposure to a lot of chemicals. A lot of us don't realize the exposure we've had. A lot of us had exposure to trauma. If you've had trauma, typically you probably have a little bit of PTSD. And I know you're in denial, veteran, but you need to find out whether or not you got some demons out there chasing you every night when you're laying in bed about the things you saw and the things you experienced. If you've had trauma, you probably have PTSD. There's no shame in finding out about it, because when you find out about it, then you can get a hold of that demon and you can move on with your life.
Okay. What's the best way to do this filing thing?
Well, the first thing I would tell a veteran is go online and go to va.gov. va.gov has a lot of information that will walk you through the process. Working for a private attorney, when I submit the paperwork, I do it all by certified mail to make sure that the VA actually receives that paperwork. If you file electronically or if you file by fax, I'm going to just be honest with you, sometimes it doesn't seem to always work. So as an attorney's office, we do everything by certified mail, document everything. But the veteran needs to go online, open up his portal account at va.gov and file intent. Put the flag in the ground and start the clock for your back payment. You're losing $10, $20, $30 a day at least if you don't do that. So if you're a veteran, listen to me, go file intent, get the flag in the ground. Now you have a year to file your claim.
Okay. So how much do you get and how is it assigned?
Well, there's assignments from 0% all the way to 100%. Obviously, if you can get an assignment of 100%, I call that the brass ring, and that's the big win. Most guys come in at 10, 20, 50%, 70%, and it's a graduated scale. Anywhere from $165 a month to $4,000 a month, depending upon the number of disabilities, injuries that you're claiming, and the evidence you have submitted about how severe it is. Most veterans have a claim out there they need to file. And even if it comes back and they say, yeah, it's service connected, but it's 0%, at least then you've established that you've had the disability and you can get treatment support at the VA clinics.
Sounds good. We're about out of time. Is that a final comment?
I'm just telling the veterans, I am proud to have served with you. Don't be so proud of yourself and your time of service that you can't file for that VA claim. The money's out there. The country says you're entitled. You gave up the best years of your life serving your country, and the money is there. The VA is a good organization, but it's complex as government, as bureaucracy. Seek somebody that can help you navigate.
Mark, thank you. Thank you for what you're doing for veterans now and for your service to our nation when you're in uniform. I'm proud that you're my friend.
As I am proud to have served with you, sir.
Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll talk with two Marines about our southern border and books that you might like. Then we'll open our weekly mailbag. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm twice. Then take a break, but stay in the area. I'll be right back. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code.
HelpVet.net was created to be the nation's number one resource center for all veterans, active military, and families. At HelpVet.net, you'll find up-to-date information on benefits available through the VA, resources on education, employment, health and wellness, and more. Find hundreds of nationally recognized organizations offering discounts on products and services, as well as local organizations from attorneys to yoga studios. You'll find them at HelpVet.net. Visit HelpVet.net for all your family's needs.
Welcome back to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, I really do welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com or comment on Facebook. It's a real pleasure to welcome a new feature to the show that will be on once each month. It's called Marine B&B. Two Marines, Gil Mazza and Skip Coriel, will each be presenting a separate topic. Gil will update us on what's going on our southern border, and Skip will present some books that might interest you. Let's get started. Gil, you were a Marine for 4 years and later served as a patrol person in the San Diego, California area. Am I right?
Border Patrol agent, yeah, in San Diego sector.
Welcome, Gil. And Skip, of course, is our co-host. He's on regularly. So, Skip, I'm glad you're doing this one, too.
Well, I do whatever you order me to do, Colonel.
I remember that at times. Okay, Gil, talk to us about the border.
Well, first of all, let's just say that the Biden border crisis is as bad as it's ever been, but this administration is getting really good at hiding it, okay? First of all, that brand new government-sponsored CBP One app, and I call it a government-sponsored smuggling app, now has taken up the slack for the so-called 70% decline in illegal crossings in the field. But this doesn't mean that the agents and the sectors across the country are not completely overwhelmed anyway. They've been over 1,000% overwhelmed since the 890 days of this administration. It's been a crisis ever since then. So between that and the fact that there's still overwhelming numbers going on every month out in the field, and not only that, but the numbers of gotaways, which we have no way of knowing. We have no metric, no measurable way of knowing unless there are agents out in the field, either cutting sign, tracking, counting the numbers, or we see them on camera recordings. But nothing has changed. They simply have rechanneled all the illegal entries in the field through the CBP One app, and now they don't have to call them illegal entries.
Wow. So Our country is being invaded, literally, by huge numbers, but we're making it legal and putting a nice spin on it. But it's still an invasion, isn't it, Gil?
Completely. And that's the thing. So we Americans have seen day after day after day since this administration began, the videos, the clips, the newscasts of military-aged men, right, coming in. Yes, there's a lot of families, there's a lot of children that have come in as well. but the majority is a single adult males. And not only that now, but because of the app, let's get this straight. They know this app now. And what I mean by they is the cartels and the illegals coming from across 170 countries. They know this app better than we do now. And now they're not bothering to cross the border. They're just starting to fly in. They're just starting to fly in. And you have to be in the proximity. You have to be either in Mexico or someplace close to even apply. So tell me that's not an incentive.
Well, clearly, we are facilitating, if nothing else, we're making life for the cartels in Mexico much easier and more profitable.
Well, we're finishing the journey for them, which is great for them because they get paid for the trip. And unfortunately, this administration has turned our dedicated and loyal men and women who took the oath to protect this country from enemies, both foreign and domestic, who take it very seriously, and they reduce them to smugglers, traffickers, and simply processors, while much of other law enforcement agencies throughout Texas and Arizona are doing their job. And let me tell you, they loathe it. They hate it.
Gil, back when you decided to join the Border Patrol, it wasn't like this. Would you have joined it if it was like this?
That's a good question. First of all, I'll be honest with you. If they hadn't mandatory retired me at 57, I would still be there. Why? Not so much because of this nightmarish mess one way or the other, but standing alongside my brothers and sisters and helping them through this process and working with them.
That's true. When you're going through something this bad, standing with your brothers and sisters is what makes it doable.
Yes.
And I understand that while it's nowhere near as bad, the northern border isn't particularly secure either, is it?
The northern border has already broken all-time historic records, not only in the 100-year history of the patrol, but in the 246-year history of this country, has never seen as many entries and illegal entries in this last couple of years and this, that it's seen in the last 9 years put together.
That's horrible.
Yeah, so it is a mess all the way around, but I got to hand it to this administration, boy. They sure know how to brush it out. They sure know how to, you know, smooth it out. But with the cooperation of this DHS secretary, I'm not going to use the words that are in my mind. I'm going to use good words. And even the cooperation of many of the higher ups in CBP, which boggles my mind because most of those people wore green uniforms, put on a badge, and made the oath as well. How they defend and endorse and champion this secretary and the policies of this administration is literally mind-blowing to me.
Yes, sir.
Gil, this doesn't surprise me at all, but it does make me angry. I hate being lied to by my government. I mean, it's like we've almost grown to expect the government to lie to us, and that in itself is a pretty sad state of affairs.
Yes, it is, Skip. Here's the thing, too, is that I've made my bones in the last 4 years in social media just being an angry person. And people are like, why don't you just enjoy your retirement? Why aren't you just, you know, enjoying your life? And I am. I'm living the dream. Don't get me wrong. My retirement is glorious. My grandkids, my travel and everything else. But the men and women of the Border Patrol across this country get a hold of me daily telling me the nightmarish. And we haven't even talked about the tip of the iceberg of the things they've been forced to do, the criminal things they've been forced to do to brush out for this administration, and the massive release of men and women into this country from other countries, not even vetted. They talked about one terrorist coming in last April, and trust me, that is not even close. And their excuse is, well, those are FARC terrorists from Venezuela. They're not they're not actual terrorists, you know, like that are on the... But they're all, well, why are they on the watch list then?
That's a good question.
Why are they on the watch list and why are we releasing them? But I remember Mayorkas saying at one point that, don't worry, we know where they are, we know where to get them, and the border is secure.
You know? Okay. Gil, thank you. We'll be getting your report every month. And now it's time to hear about some books from Skip. Skip, you're a co-host. You know how the game plays. Pick up the ball that Gil just put down. And talk to us about some books we might be interested in.
Well, Colonel, go ahead.
Before you do, Skip, I honestly did not know that the grunts read books.
Yeah, well, we are in the minority, okay? But don't worry, all of these books I'm recommending have very small words.
Ah, very good.
Okay. All right. The book that I've chosen this month is called The Killer Angel, written by Michael Shera. And a lot of people think, I've never heard of this guy. Well, he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. The Killer Angels, that's the book, a historical fiction about the Civil War. And that's the book that they used to do the film Gettysburg. And that's a fairly, that was in 1993, I believe, when that movie was released. But that's what made Michael Shera famous. That's his claim to fame there. Oddly enough, that book didn't make the New York Times bestseller list until 19 years after it was first published. He wrote this book after visiting Gettysburg with his son, Jeffrey, who is an author in his own right. And it was not a very successful, commercially successful book. It was rejected 15 times, finally published by a small independent publisher, didn't sell very well at all. And even after he won the Pulitzer Prize, you know, in 1975, 2 years after it was published, it still was not commercially viable, and it just kind of fell by the wayside until they made that movie. But, you know, he never lived to see the movie because he died in 1988, 5 years before the movie came out. So it's kind of sad in that regard because he died believing that he had failed as an author when he was writing this book. But, you know, a lot of our listeners have probably seen the movie and love the movie and learn a lot about the Battle of Gettysburg from watching that movie. And I think one of my favorite characters in the book, The Killer Angels, was Colonel Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, you know, the colonel of the 20th Maine Regiment. You know, he was the one that turned back the Alabama Regiment at Little Round Top, and he later won the Medal of Honor. 30 years after the battle, they awarded him the Medal of Honor. And that just shows, you know, how much the government can procrastinate. But, you know, this guy, he was a professor of rhetoric at Bowdoin College in Maine. He spoke 7 languages. He served in 20 battles. He was cited for bravery 4 times, wounded 6 times. He had 6 horses shot out from under him during the Civil War. And then he served 4 one-year terms as Maine governor. And then he died in 1914 of wounds suffered from the Battle of Petersburg. So, boy, this book is just an awesome book, and everyone will absolutely love it because it tells a lot more details than you get from the movie. And that's one of the reasons I recommend it, Colonel.
Killer Angels. Thank you, Skip. That's a great report. Thank you, Gil, for joining us, kicking off Marines B&B, and for joining the Front Lines of Freedom team. And Skip, get back to work. You're on in about 2 minutes.
You bet, Colonel.
Skip, I just want to say that that last general you spoke about goes through horses like Border Patrol agents go through vehicles.
That's right. Well, you know, Colonel Chamberlain, his men loved him, but the horses hated him.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Next up, it's time for our weekly mailbag. Then it's military history time. You reported for duty, Front Lines of Freedom. Stand tall, troops. Let's do some more push-ups. How about 60 this time? I want your ranger ready. Then stand at ease.
$30 trillion in debt, 20 years of endless war, and veterans not able to get the care they deserve. These are some of the issues concerned Veterans for America is confronting head-on. At CVA, we aim to amplify the veteran perspective to create a better future for all Americans. But we need your help. Join CVA in shaping a better tomorrow for you, your family, and your community. Visit cv4a.org to learn more and join the movement. That's cv4a.org.
Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Front Lines of Freedom. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I really welcome comments from you, our listeners. Do send your thoughts to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com or on Facebook. What's the first one, Skip?
Well, Colonel, Michael said he was driving and listening to the show and heard a couple of books mentioned he was interested in. Could you tell him what the books were?
Well, Michael, I sent the book information to you. Troops, if you're ever in the situation Michael was in, please go to the Frontlines of Freedom website. The show plays on the weekend. By Sunday evening, the entire show is posted as a podcast on our website. You can play it as many times as you want to then. Enjoy it.
And Suzette, a Navy vet, always intuitively knew that all this climate change stuff was goofy. She was really pleased to hear some real science on the subject. Thanks.
You're welcome, Suzette. Yes, we heard real science from Steve Gorham. To say that climate change is a problem is nonsense. And now it's time for military history. Take us there, bro.
Well, Colonel, on 21 July 1861, the Civil War erupted on a large scale in the East when Confederate forces under P.T. Beauregard turned back Union General Irvin McDowell's troops along the Bull Run Stream in Virginia. The inexperienced soldiers on both sides slugged it out in a chaotic battle that resulted in a humiliating retreat by the Yankees and signaled for many the true start of the war. At the insistence of President Lincoln, McDowell set out to make a quick offensive against Manassas Junction, a key rail center 30 miles from Washington, D.C. On July 18, the Yankee advance was halted in a small skirmish at Blackburn's Ford on Bull Run. McDowell paused for 3 days as he prepared to move around the rebels. This delay allowed forces under Joseph Johnston to join Beauregard. A brigade commanded by Thomas Jackson was among the reinforcements. McDowell attacked the center of the Confederate line, but his main attack came around the rebel left flank. By noon, the Confederates retreated. Then McDowell moved in to capture Henry Hill, the key to the battle, but he didn't send a big enough force, and that allowed Beauregard to strengthen his force there. During the battle, rebel General Barnard Bee reinforced Jackson on Henry Hill. He was reported to have characterized Jackson as standing like a stone wall. Jackson's men held their ground. Then the rebels counterattacked and broke McDowell's force, which triggered a panicked and confused retreat. The inexperienced Federals found their escape route clogged by the buggies of spectators who came from Washington to watch the action. The green Union troops had a difficult time of it, but the equally green Confederates didn't pursue. The casualties shocked the nation. The Union had 2,800, including 460 killed, and the Confederates 1,900 with nearly 400 dead. Although future battles would make these numbers appear small, they were a wake-up call to a public in both the North and the South, unprepared for such a bloody conflict. And Colonel, I visited that battle site. It's just an awesome place to go. I recommend our listeners do that if they can.
Good way to see what American history really looked like. On 18 July 1918, during World War I, 3 days after a German offensive near the Marne River in the Champagne region of France failed, Allied forces launched a major counterattack, ending the Second Battle of the Marne and decisively turning the tide of the war toward the Allied victory. Casualties were staggering. Germany lost 168,000 soldiers, compared with 95,000 for the French, 13,000 for the British, and 12,000 for us. After this disaster, Germany was forced to call off a planned offensive further north, which could have been Germany's best hope of victory. In the end, the Second Battle of the Marne marked the last large-scale German offensive of World War I.
And on 19 July 1943, during World War II, the U.S. bombed railway yards in Rome in an attempt to break the will of the Italian people to resist, as Hitler lectured their leader, Benito Mussolini, on how to fight the war. On July 16, President Franklin Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill appealed to the Italian civilian population to reject Mussolini and Hitler and live for Italy and civilization. As an incentive, American bombers raided the city, destroying its railways. Panic broke out among the Romans. Convinced by Mussolini that the Allies would never bomb the Holy City, civilians poured into the Italian capital for safety. The bombing did more than shake their security in the city. It shook their confidence in their leader.
And on 20 July 1948, during the Cold War, President Harry Truman instituted a military draft with a proclamation calling for nearly 10 million men to register for military service within the next 2 months. Truman's action came during increasing Cold War tensions with the Soviet Union. Following World War II, the U.S. moved quickly to demobilize the vast military it had constructed. During the war, over 16 million men and women served in our military. By 1948, less than 550,000 remained in the army. This small size concerned our leaders, who believed that a confrontation with the Soviet Union was imminent. Following World War II, relations between Russia and America deteriorated rapidly. Secretary of State George Marshall warned that Western Europe was on the brink of political and economic chaos and that would leave it defenseless against communist aggression. Congress approved billions of dollars in financial assistance. And in June 1948, the Soviets cut all land traffic into the U.S., British, French zones of occupation in West Berlin. The U.S. responded with a Berlin airlift in which tons of food and supplies were flown into the city to sustain the population. Many felt that an actual combat was not far away. Thus, President Truman reinstituted the draft. In 1950, the possibility turned into reality when we entered the Korean War and the size of America's armed forces once again increased dramatically. And that's military history for today. Now it's time for our self-defense report. Take us there, Skip.
All of us here at Frontlines of Freedom believe strongly in your right to keep and bear arms for protection of yourself and your family. All across the country, violent crime is skyrocketing, and now, more than ever, Americans need to stand up and exercise their Second Amendment rights. Now is the time to get trained and ready to handle this growing threat. But if you're not, please look into it and learn what you can do to legally carry a firearm to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Well, at about 12:30 a.m. Saturday, two masked men forced their way into the home of a 73-year-old lady, Linda Ellis. The men demanded money and shot Ellis in her leg. That's when her 12-year-old grandson grabbed a gun and opened fire in self-defense, causing the intruders to flee the home. Police found one of the suspects, identified as 19-year-old Khalil Herring, at a nearby intersection suffering from a gunshot wound. He later died as a result of the injuries, officials said. 73-year-old Ellis was hospitalized with non-life-threatening injuries. Police say charges are not expected to be filed against the 12-year-old boy.
Thanks, Colonel. One of the questions I routinely get from my students is this: when should I allow my children to access my firearms? Many people have a knee-jerk emotional reaction to this and perhaps would even become angry about the topic, saying in unequivocal terms, no one should ever allow a minor access to firearms. But I don't agree with that. I grew up out in the country where legal firearms use was quite common. There was always a loaded shotgun leaning in a corner ready for use against animal predators that would occasionally pilfer a chicken or two. At about age 12, my father gave me access to a .22 caliber rifle, which I used on a weekly basis to shoot crows, starlings, and house sparrows. Some people are aghast at that, but quite frankly, back in the 1960s, it was quite common for children to be taught how to use firearms by their parents. It was considered normal and good and a rite of passage. Fast forward to 2023, and things have changed drastically. In some jurisdictions, parents can be charged with a felony for allowing their kids to shoot guns unsupervised. Because of that legal and cultural reality, I keep all my guns locked up. Now, don't get me wrong, I still teach my kids how to safely handle guns, how to clean them, hunt with them, and even how to use them for personal protection. But it's more formal now than when I was a kid. In today's age of liberal demonization of all firearms and firearms owners, I highly recommend you keep your guns locked up, but that you also actively teach your children gun safety and marksmanship. Teach them that guns are good in the hands of good people. This 12-year-old boy shot and killed a man. That puts him in a category that even most law enforcement officers and soldiers never attain. At 12 years old, he's not capable of processing that emotionally on his own. He'll need help from people who love him so that he can get on with his childhood. If I were to meet this boy, I would console him, but I would also thank him for the service he did to society. I would reassure him that even though what he did was unpleasant, it was also very necessary and that he saved the life of his grandmother and possibly even his own life. What you did was moral and just. Frontlines of Freedom salutes this North Carolina boy and wishes him all the best as he grows into a capable and virtuous young man.
Well said, Skip. Our movie of the month is Two Strangers Who Met Five Times. You can go to the Frontlines of Freedom website, go to the blog, and get the link. You can watch it for free. We're going to review it at the end of the month, and I would appreciate getting your comments. Send them to me at Denny at frontlinesoffreedom.com. Next week on Frontlines of Freedom, it's the anniversary of President Truman desegregating our military in 1948. We'll be discussing that with Rosie and Dwayne. Then we'll talk with American Legion National Commander Torriola about the Legion, and General Brian Kelly, the head of the Military Officers Association of America, will discuss their current goals, and General Chris Petty will present the Battle of the Month. Our book, Frontlines of Freedom, with 19 authors, has the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and help our nation return to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. And it's now available in Spanish. You can purchase this book on frontlinesoffreedom.com or Amazon. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Frontlines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. Please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, hey, all our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the front lines of freedom. Stand tall, be proud Americans, and join me next week for military and veteran information that you will not get anywhere else on the front lines of freedom. Dismissed.